¡Aquí hay niños!
Están aquí, sácalo, ven mi amor, por ahí. No, no, no le vais a raspar.
Se cayeron los postes de luz, mira, por poquito le cayó a ese coche. El poste de luz le cayó a mi carro. A una señora le cayó, acá le cayó a la señora. ¡Háblale a una ambulancia, rápido!
Scenes from central Mexico yesterday after a 7.1 magnitude quake devastated that region, including Mexico City. You heard a man shouting, "There are children here," another man talking about light posts falling, one fell on his car, another fell on a woman. He called for an ambulance, fast. More than 225 people have died, including 30 school children. Homes, schools, other buildings collapsed. The government has declared a state of disaster in Mexico City. We're going to see now how the relief efforts have been going with Eric Martin. He's a reporter for Bloomberg in Mexico City. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. What are you seeing on the ground? What did you see today during your reporting?
It's been just an absolutely catastrophic scene. We saw yesterday, particularly last night, collapsed buildings in many parts of Mexico City in the upscale and wealthier neighborhoods of Roma Norte and Condesa. The smell of gas wafting through the air, just overwhelming, being near some of those buildings, people shouting at bystanders and passersby on the street not to light cigarettes because they were afraid of explosions. So, you know, on the one hand, this really horrific scene of destruction and devastation. And yet, on the other hand, you've really seen the spirit of the Mexican people literally running into some of these scenes to be able to help, carrying pounds of many bottles of water or batteries or flashlights, blankets, just whatever is needed to help the rescue crews and to take care of the victims of this tragedy.
And it's still a search and rescue operation, right? People are still scrambling through the rubble trying to find survivors?
Absolutely. We've seen in a school in the south of the city that the rescue teams have been working around the clock for now longer than 24 hours because they believe that some children still are trapped. Every once in a while, you'll see them raise their fist, which has been a kind of the common icon for this experience and this situation, raising their fist to call for silence so they can hear. And a child who's trapped in the rubble of a collapsed four-story building, which has now collapsed down to one story, will either make a sound or tap on something so they know that they're still alive. And we've seen several children extracted that way today. So just really dramatic scenes and people still holding out hope that someone could potentially survive if they had the triangle of life or some way of protecting themselves from the falling debris that perhaps 24, 36, 48, hours, 3 days later, somebody could still be found alive in some of these situations.
Wow. Okay, so as the search and rescue operation continues, what is the need for supplies, for help, for aid from perhaps here in the United States?
Absolutely. There are a number of ways that people can donate. I know that the Mexican Red Cross is taking donations. We've seen people in Mexico City coming out and bringing regular objects from their house. I know I brought down a neighbor passing me in the hallway, said that trash bags were needed, plastic bags, and so I gave him five full boxes of plastic bags that I had in my kitchen. There's really everything, any kind of resource that people can come up with and scrape together is being appreciated here and is being put to use. And certainly for your listeners, you know, to go online and look for those ways to reach out and to help, you know, would be extremely appreciated by the people, you know, who we cover here in Mexico.
What is the government saying about regular people helping out versus a more coordinated official search and rescue effort?
Well, the government is certainly monitoring in some of these cases, putting up police cordons with, you know, with yellow tape and keeping citizens from themselves becoming injured and becoming victims as a result of trying to help. But there is this spirit about the volunteer effort that largely comes out of the experience 32 years ago where the government was slow to react and civil society had to be the one doing the heavy lifting. And so there's a strong tradition of that in Mexico, and people feel a pride and an investment in that. So you really see people wanting to be engaged, wanting to do anything that they can, really extremely selfless behavior in terms of going in and helping strangers and coming together as a community.
Eric Martin, reporter for Bloomberg in Mexico City. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Yesterday's earthquake happened on the 32nd anniversary of an even bigger earthquake that killed thousands of people in Mexico City back in 1985. Add to that, southern Mexico suffered a big quake less than 2 weeks ago, and we here in Los Angeles experienced a minor quake this week. So, are we seeing increased earthquake activity? Lucy Jones is now a retired seismologist, formerly with the U.S. Geological Survey, and an earthquake expert. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, do you think these recent quakes are connected in any way?
The two Mexican earthquakes are probably related. The magnitude 8 may have triggered the magnitude 7. No connection to Southern California. The ability of an earthquake to trigger another one is controlled by the length of the fault it moves on, which is the magnitude. So a magnitude 8 can affect several hundred miles around it. A magnitude 3.6, which happens on a fault the size of a football field, affects maybe a mile.
And is Mexico City and the surrounding area, is it particularly susceptible to earthquakes?
Well, actually, I mean, the coast of Mexico has many big earthquakes. It's a subduction zone. It's a plate tectonic boundary, just like the San Andreas Fault is. So it has a lot of earthquakes. Farther inland, they're much rarer. And there are not nearly as many of the big earthquakes this close in. And, you know, you said that the 85 earthquake was bigger, which, yes, it was, but it was also a lot farther away from Mexico City. So for the damage in Mexico City, being much closer to the earthquake has a lot of impact. And it's a mistake we see a lot, in sort of a challenge to our way of thinking about them. The magnitude doesn't tell you what you feel. Mm-hmm. It tells you how much energy was released by the earth. And if it was released a ways away from you, it really doesn't make that much difference.
Mexico City, though, is built on pretty soft soil, right? A former lake bed.
Right. There's an abandoned lake, a former lake bed that's the base of much of the city. And they're extremely, we would even say, pathologic soils. So they get an amplifying of the seismic waves by like a factor of 100. So being in, you know, that big earthquake that killed so many people in 85, people in the mountains around the lake bed, the hills on the edges of Mexico City, some of them didn't even feel it.
Hmm.
So, you know, that Mexico City is very bad. We have a smaller version of that anywhere you have a basin filled with sediment. So the Los Angeles basin has amplifying soils as well, but for us it's about a factor of 3 to 5. In Mexico City, it's a factor of 100.
Wow.
So, right. The seismologists are all fascinated by Mexico City, but that's probably not much reassurance to the people who live there.
Well, meanwhile, the building codes were tightened after that 85 quake, but then we saw these buildings yesterday just collapse.
I think a lot of them are older buildings. So the earthquake produces energy at a lot of frequencies. The high-frequency energy dies off more quickly than low-frequency. Just like when you hear somebody with a boombox going down the street, when they're a long ways away from you, you can only hear the beat. You can't hear the melody anymore. That's the low frequencies traveling farther than the high frequencies. And this is important because buildings have a natural frequency. And so when 85 hit, it came in with this huge amount of energy in really low frequencies, but only in low frequencies. So the buildings that were damaged then were the taller buildings. They were between 5 and 20 stories high. And below 5 stories, the buildings were okay because there wasn't any high-frequency energy left. This time, the earthquake's coming in much closer with a lot more high-frequency energy, and we're seeing a lot of damage to older buildings in these shorter ranges that didn't get damaged in 85 because they were too small, but now we're getting the high-frequency energy that hits them.
Let's talk about the early warning system. Mexico does have one. It was put in place in 91. But according to some tweets, it didn't work so well. One man tweeted that his wife died and blames the lack of an alarm, a lack of warning. And then someone else tweeted in response, it didn't ring because the earthquake was not on the coast. It is urgent to standardize the coastal alerts with inland ones. So what's happening?
Okay, so Mexico did have the very earliest early warning system, and that early one was very simple. It said, most of our big earthquakes are on the coast, but we're still killing people in Mexico City because of our horrible soils. So if we ever see a big earthquake at the coast, let's ring an alarm in Mexico City and get people out of these buildings because it's going to take a long time for the waves to get here from 200 miles away, but they'll still do damage because we have these awful soils. So they were able to do a very simple system that only looked at coastal earthquakes and their impact in Mexico City. So they've been expanding it since then. And I've heard mixed reports. It sounds like the newer system that's trying to combine with the inland ones did get some warning. But, you know, if people believed that that 60 seconds they got from the coast was something they were going to get for every earthquake, then they might not have responded quickly enough.
Right.
And it's one of the really big challenges with early warning is that it's not a simple, oh, it's coming, now it's over situation. As you know, when you look at how we're going to try and do it here in California, we don't get to say the earthquakes are all in one location and people are in another. We have people everywhere and we have earthquakes everywhere. So we're having to create a much more complex system. And, you know, when we have our big earthquakes, we might be getting a message as, oh, an earthquake's begun on the San Andreas, but it's only going to be weak shaking here. And 10, 20 seconds later, oh, the earthquake hasn't stopped moving on the San Andreas, so now we think the shaking's going to be stronger here. And then, oh, wow, it looks like the fault's breaking all the way up close to you, so it's going to be really strong shaking here. And we're going to have to do that sort of gradational message. That's going to require education on how to use it. And I think that's going to be one of the big challenges we face, and it's sort of what we're seeing in Mexico City. It worked according to the scientists, but it's not an easy-to-use message.
When are we getting an early warning system here?
Okay, so the prototype is in place. Right now, the federal government has allocated about half of the funding that's needed to run the full system. So it's on its way, but it's not fully staffed or fully operational. I believe that the USGS, who I no longer work for, and so I'm not in on their most recent plans, was hoping to be able to do a pilot release for Southern California in 2018.
Next year. Okay. Well, that's some comfort, I suppose.
Hopefully we get in before the earthquake.
Hopefully. Lucy, you are the busiest retired seismologist around. I want to thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. And I must say, I've actually started the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society to try and take this type of information out to people who can use it. So I'm retired from the federal government, but it'll be a while before I stop working.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There's an outbreak of hepatitis A in Los Angeles County. Health officials say there are 10 confirmed cases. It's affecting Los Angeles's homeless population and the people who work with them. The disease isn't usually life-threatening, but it is highly contagious, and it is a major public health issue. Joining us now is Sarah Kurian. She's Deputy Medical Director for the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us what you know about this outbreak. Where and how did it start?
There's been an ongoing outbreak in both San Diego and Santa Cruz counties for a while now. So, you know, LA County has been bracing for the possibility of cases coming into Los Angeles. And so for a while now, we've been preparing and trying to stave off a potential outbreak. But in the last couple of weeks, we've had a couple of cases that have had connection to San Diego come up to the LA area. And then just yesterday, we were actually able to confirm that we had two community-acquired cases, which would meet a definition of having a local outbreak here in LA County.
So when you say you were preparing for this, what did that entail?
So we were doing a lot of outreach. We were working with our community partners who work within the homeless populations to provide education to the homeless and to actually start vaccinating the homeless to help prevent infection taking root in our community.
What about sanitation? What about providing more bathrooms, providing more places where they can wash their hands, bleaching the streets, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so LA City actually has a very aggressive street cleaning protocol already in place. The department is working with cities to try and improve bathroom access, make available 24/7 public bathrooms. So those are all things that we are currently working on trying to get out there.
Well, is that the major problem then, that there aren't enough places for them to go to the bathroom and wash their hands? And that's one of the worries?
You know, yes, hygiene is a major problem with hepatitis A and can be a major cause of why it can be spread. And so that is an area that we are focusing on.
And so are you pretty confident you'll have a handle on this and it won't spread?
So we are doing everything we can to make sure that that doesn't happen. We've got quite a number of folks within our department that are really focused on this effort now. So I think with this very concerted effort across the county, we're very hopeful that we will have this under control.
Sarah Kurian, Deputy Medical Director for the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, to San Diego now, where the Hepe outbreak has killed 16 people and put more than 400 in the hospital. As in Los Angeles, the outbreak is mostly affecting San Diego's homeless population. Lisa Halverstadt is a reporter with Voice of San Diego, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, how long has San Diego been dealing with this outbreak?
Well, we first actually declared an outbreak here in March. The initial cases look to be, you know, going back to November or so, late November. And in the months since, this has really ramped up quite a bit. And so actually on September 1st, the county declared a health emergency associated with this outbreak. So it's been going on for quite a while.
But it seems to, as you say, have ramped up recently. How come?
This is something that spreads very easily. So if one person is exposed, then they potentially, interact with a couple other people who become exposed, and then it just continues to grow. What we've also seen is that in the past few months, the deaths have really ramped up as well.
Mm. And also the incubation period is long. It's about a month, so you can spread it without even knowing you have it.
Exactly.
And it's mainly confined to the homeless population in San Diego?
So about 64% of the folks who've gotten this have been homeless or illicit drug users or both. So that is a good chunk of the population. Certainly they're disproportionately affected by this. People who are living on the street just do not have the same access to public restrooms that most of us do. And so it's, you know, more difficult for them then to wash their hands or to have a safe place to go to the restroom.
Okay, so what has the city's response been?
Well, so early on, the County of San Diego is the public health agency. They really focused a lot on vaccinations. At this point, they've vaccinated and partners have vaccinated almost 23,000 people. They were sending foot teams out to go and do vaccines in the homeless population since people are living in encampments and other places. And it's, you know, not as easy for a homeless person to just walk into a clinic. But what is the more recent development is that the sanitation piece of this had not really been a focus. The efforts were kind of what some have described as kind of lethargic in terms of the, you know, what the city of San Diego and other cities' responses have been. So more recently, we've seen a few extra restrooms be opened up. Hours have been extended at some restrooms. Now there are hand-washing stations that have been put up throughout the city, about 40 of them. And there are also efforts to partly bleach the streets in downtown because they're realizing literally the downtown at one point in a document was declared a fecally contaminated environment.
Ew.
And that's really an issue in terms of, you know, trying to combat this.
Yeah. Well, is there any fear that this will spread out of the homeless population into the general population of San Diego?
Well, there is a percentage of folks, I believe it's about 24%, who have been infected who are not in one of those at-risk categories. So this is something that is affecting people outside of that population. But what they're finding is that there tends to be some kind of connection to the homeless population, whether that person is working with homeless individuals at a nonprofit provider. Other cases, though, it's kind of up in the air, and I think that there is certainly some fear about that. There's also fear about the fact that there really isn't a source that's been identified for this, so San Diego can't really say, you know, what the cause of this is. We just know that it's being spread person to person, where a lot of other hepatitis A outbreaks that we've seen have been foodborne.
Mm-hmm.
This does not fit that pattern. One thing that I would also note is that, you know, just the arc of this, one thing that was emphasized yesterday where officials were trying to really spread information to the public about how to combat this and what they can do to help was that this is likely to continue for 6 months, maybe even more, because of the nature of how this is spreading and you know, the efforts that will have to be undertaken to combat it.
Lisa Halverstadt, reporter with Voice of San Diego, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's alive. The Obamacare repeal and replace plan back from the dead. Now, Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy say they're very close to getting the 51 votes needed to pass their bill by the September 30th deadline. Cassidy and Graham say this plan will give more control to the states. But last night, Jimmy Kimmel used his stand-up to call Cassidy a liar. He said the bill failed Cassidy's own Jimmy Kimmel test.
These were his words. He said he wants coverage for all, no discrimination based on pre-existing conditions, lower premiums for middle-class families, and no lifetime caps. And guess what? The new bill does none of those things.
Here to tell us more is Noam Levy. He's national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back, Noam.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
Well, is Jimmy Kimmel right when he says there will be no lifetime caps gotten rid of, the pre-existing condition thing gone? Higher premiums for middle-class families?
So I would have to say that the almost universal opinion among advocates for patients, physicians, hospitals, health insurers, now a growing number of independent analyses suggest Jimmy Kimmel is correct.
Okay. So what chances does this have of passing now?
I think it's close. I don't think Republicans are quite there yet. So the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, has indicated that he wants to have a vote next week. Recall Republicans fell just one vote shy of advancing this repeal push over the summer. So all it would take would be one of the three Republican senators who voted against the repeal legislation in July to flip, and this effectively clears the Senate.
And those three were Maine's Susan Collins, Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, and Arizona's John McCain?
That's right. Recall, Republicans have 52 votes in the Senate. They need 50 to advance this because a tie would be broken by the vice president. Susan Collins has indicated some pretty strong reservations about this latest proposal. John McCain and Lisa Murkowski have not committed one way or the other yet. Rand Paul, interestingly, a very conservative Republican senator from Kentucky who did back the earlier versions, has been very critical of the latest proposal and said he won't support it because it actually doesn't go far enough, in his view, in rolling back the Affordable Care Act. But there is some skepticism, I think, that he will maintain that opposition if he's the last vote stopping what would essentially roll back a large part of the bill.
Right. And didn't he say that last time and then he went ahead and voted for it?
He did. He did. McCain is an interesting McCain and Murkowski, I think, are very interesting here. Murkowski had a lot of reservations about the process the last time around. She was very supportive of a bipartisan process that seemed to be gaining some steam until recently in the Senate. And her governor, a former Republican, now an independent, has come out against this, saying it would be detrimental to Alaska. Now, John McCain has delivered a number of calls for a more, a less rushed, a more reasoned, a more bipartisan process. That's, of course, the sort of cri de coeur that he issued on the floor of the Senate when he cast a dramatic vote to stop the repeal process in July. On the other hand, Lindsey Graham, this Republican senator from South Carolina, is one of the co-authors of this bill. Lindsey Graham's arguably John McCain's best friend in the Senate. That may play a role. And Arizona's governor, a Republican, has come out in support of it as well. So a lot of people will be watching John McCain for sure.
But the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has not weighed in on this, right? Has not scored it.
That's correct. The Congressional Budget Office, which lawmakers traditionally rely on to assess the impact of big pieces of legislation like this one, said there's not enough time between now and when Senate Republicans want to vote next week to do the kind of analysis that they've done in the past. And the key things that will therefore be missing will be, what impact would this potentially have on how many Americans have health insurance? And secondly, what will this do to the premiums, the insurance premiums that Americans pay. Now, that even without a CBO analysis, though, I think it's important to note that there are some independent analyses coming forward, some more released today, that build on work the Congressional Budget Office has done in the past and also look at just the raw numbers of what is in this latest proposal, calculating more than $200 billion in cuts of federal assistance to state health care programs over the next decade, and some provisions in this bill that would, as Jimmy Kimmel suggested, erode some of those consumer protections in the Affordable Care Act. Taken together, I think it's reasonable at this point to assume that even if the Congressional Budget Office doesn't complete an analysis, it's safe to assume that there probably will be significant coverage reductions under this proposal. And it's very likely that people who are sick in a lot of states around the country could see themselves paying more for coverage going forward.
Okay, so previous estimates said that anywhere between 16 million and 32 million people would lose their insurance in the next decade or so with the previous bills.
That's right.
And so maybe ballpark that would be the same with this one?
It's very difficult to say. The structure of these of this proposal is different.
Uh-huh.
But one thing that is certain is that in 2026, a decade from now, this new proposal, this Graham-Cassidy proposal, would cut this federal support for states. Congress would have to act to reauthorize that and come up with something like $1 trillion in 10 years to continue federal assistance to states for their health care safety nets.
Meaning Medicaid.
Including Medicaid.
Yeah.
Some Medicaid would continue, some Medicaid would be subject to this cut. So there is an open question about what happens after 2026. Will Congress be able to come up with the money to keep these programs going? We would hope so. On the other hand, the Children's Health Insurance Program, a much smaller program that enjoys bipartisan support, is just days away from expiring because Congress has not acted to reauthorize that. So a lot of question marks about how many people could be assured coverage going forward.
And then it also gets rid of the individual mandate, right? And so that would mean that people could just not buy health insurance if they didn't want to and face no penalties, meaning that presumably younger, healthier people would be out of the insurance pool, which is what keeps the rates, you know, lower than they would normally be.
That's right. And, of course, the mandate's been very unpopular, so it's been a part getting rid of it's been a part of pretty much every Republican repeal proposal. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated in the past, and health insurers have warned as well, that without a mandate, exactly as you indicated, many more people elect not to get coverage, particularly younger, healthier ones. That, again, puts upward pressure on health insurance premiums, making health insurance more expensive because only the people who are sick and presumably need those protections are going to buy it. And that, of course, leads to a death spiral, as they say, in insurance markets.
Okay, so if they do indeed pass it next week, the Senate, any indication what will happen in the House with this bill?
House Speaker Paul Ryan said yesterday that the House would pass it. Now, the assumption has always been that the Senate was the higher hurdle. Republicans control many more seats in the House than they do in the Senate. Their margin is much larger in the House than it is in the Senate. The one wild card here is that because of the funding formulas in this latest proposal, there would be a substantial shift in federal assistance away from states that have traditionally had very robust health care safety nets, like California, like New York, other states on the coast. And California in particular would see an enormous funding cut over the next decade. And that would put a lot of pressure on Republican House members from these blue states, some of whom have already indicated that they're somewhat nervous about this. And Republican governors from some of these states, Massachusetts, New Jersey, just today, Chris Christie said he was very wary, was opposed to this. The Republican governor of Maryland, of Ohio, have come out and said they don't support this. So would Republican House members from those states, whose constituents could see a major erosion in their insurance, would they vote for this? That's a question mark.
Noam Levy, healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. And now, Blank Slate, our series about the artists who shape L.A. and who are shaped by L.A. Today, painter Larry Pittman. His work has shown at every major museum here in L.A. His paintings are in the Broad's permanent collection. He's on the board at MoCA and at the Hammer, and he's been a tenured professor at UCLA since the late 1990s. Curator and museum director Lisa Phillips says that Larry Pittman is one of the most important painters of his generation because he bucked the minimalist trend before it was fashionable to do so. Pittman has been a figure in the L.A. art scene for some 40 years. We met him in his studio recently. It's a large white space tucked away in an unassuming office park in Glendale. It's cavernous, big enough to hold his massive 10-feet-wide paintings. And on a Friday afternoon, his studio is spotless.
I love the act of sweeping at the end of the day.
And are you very ordered about the time you spend working and how you organize the actual working? Are you disciplined about your work?
Yes. If it's a mess, I can't.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And I just can't.
Stressful.
Yeah, it's very stressful. And, you know, the world is a mess. So all I have here is my cell phone, which I love.
That's great.
That's it.
So you just cut yourself off from the world and create.
Yeah. And work, yeah.
Running vertically through the room is a large central table, about 40 feet long. On it are neatly organized canvases, pens, paintbrushes.
The table to me is like a big landscape, so it is always changing. You know, it's kind of laying out the tools of the trade.
Larry keeps a regular schedule. He arrives at the studio every day around 10, lays out his materials, and paints until evening.
I work on everything flat on a table, even the really big paintings that you see here. So sometimes I actually crawl on top of them to be able to reach the center.
Wow. That's a lot of acrobatics.
Primitive, I think.
Color is a big part of Larry's work.
I love this paint. It's called Cartoon Color. It was actually originally developed for cell painting in animation, but it has a nice, flat, kind of velvety quality. And unlike, let's say, traditional acrylic, when it dries, it has an ever so slight sheen to it. And there's a nice absorbency to this paint that I particularly like. And also, it's tough as nails.
Well, you're not afraid of color, that's for sure.
No, I'm not colorphobic. Some people are.
Art critic Wayne Kostenbaum describes the colors Pittman uses as shades most painters would find too garish or kitschy for fine art. Peppermint pink, pine green, raincoat yellow, mulch brown. That color is in many ways a rebellion against classic modern painting with its sparse canvases, its simple lines, subtle shades of gray. And a lot of that radical taste comes from his training at CalArts in the 1970s. At that time, most art schools emphasized painters in the modernist tradition, painters such as Jackson Pollock or Robert Motherwell. But Larry Pittman was able to enter the feminist art program at CalArts, which taught a more radical approach.
Even though men were not really technically part of the feminist program, my partner at that time, who is now my husband, we met in graduate school, and we've been together for 43 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. But we were allowed to kind of orbit around it because we were seen as civilized by the.
Is your day?
I think so. Yeah. You hit it on the head, Madeline.
Larry Pittman is not an easy painter. While some artists are minimalists, he is a maximalist. Every inch of his large canvases is covered in images. There are Visa credit cards, glittery shoes, bulging tree roots, large intestines. He uses imagery from science, comic books, advertising, and verses from American poetry. We go over to a large painting on the wall of his studio. Its colors are burnt orange, blood red, with accents of blue. There's a pair of dice on one side, a red female figure bent over on the bottom, a skeleton torso that looks like it's dancing, an electric guitar. He says it's a mix of two of his artistic heroes from the 19th century, Spanish painter Francisco Goya and American poet Emily Dickinson.
I always saw she was a mid-19th century, highly educated American woman who was clearly an atheist, a proto-feminist, and probably a lesbian.
Pittman identifies with her somewhat. He's also gay, a feminist, and an atheist, and not afraid of dark, disturbing themes or of confronting viewers with overtly sexual images. correct me if I'm wrong, but that looks like a penis.
No, it's the end of an electric guitar. See, here's the electric guitar. That's the end of the electric guitar. I'm sorry, your mind is in the gutter. Or maybe not. It's actually traveling to another place.
Thank you. You cannot tell me I'm the first person to say that.
No, No. It happens. It happens.
So don't be afraid if you look at Larry Pittman's paintings and you just don't get it. You're not supposed to. He wants you to put away that logical, puzzle-solving part of your brain and really get lost in his work, in the colors, the shapes, the feeling of it. But there's also a particular element to his work that is specific to Southern California. You grew up in Los Angeles. You went to school here, undergraduate and graduate. You have lived here your entire life, pretty much?
Yes, yes.
How do you think the city has influenced who you are as an artist? Where do you, when you look at your paintings and you look at your work and we go in there into your studio, where is Los Angeles in there?
I live in La Crescenta. Right now, as we're speaking, we're in Glendale. And then I commute to the west side to teach at UCLA. So that is a big triangle of driving. But if I can not take a freeway, I will. And sometimes I'll cross the whole city on surface streets because I love using that time to look.
Yeah, so you're saying the physical, the topography actually influences the character, the philosophical character.
When I've had many curators come to my studio over the many, many years, I started showing in Europe in the 80s. So I've had long relationships with European curators. But one of the things that they always comment on is they say, this work could have never come out of the East Coast. Your work, Larry, could have never come out of New York.
When you're done and you step away from your work, you think, what?
I've been very, very fortunate to make work that then gets exhibited. And I realize that is a luxury, you know, that I know a lot of artists don't have. So really, for the last 40 years, from the very beginning of my career, I've always exhibited the work I've made. You know, in 2019, I'm having a 40-year retrospective at the Hammer. So I'll get to see 40 years of production. So,
oh my gosh, how do you feel about that?
I'm very excited. And in looking over the list, there's nothing I'm embarrassed about, which is good.
Larry Pittman is an artist and painter based here in Los Angeles, and you can see his work and the work of the other artists in our series at kcrw.com/blankslate.